We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Society.
Part 1.
On April 18, 1943, Japanese Commander Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto left the Rabaul base in New Guinea for the Solomon Islands. It was Admiral's last flight. On his way to the island, 16 U.S. fighter jets appear in the sky and attack the Admiral. After the shooting, the plane wing falls apart and the Admiral's plane crashes in the woods. The question is, where did the planes come from? How was Yamamoto's direction revealed? The great discovery of the 19th century was the telegraph that spread all over the world like wildfire. After a while, Nikola Tesla raised the idea of global wireless communication system. But in 1914, the First World War broke out and the military projects were given priority. In the spring of 1917, America's cryptographic organization, the Black Chamber, was established and Herbert O. Yardley was designated head of the chamber. He was a telegrapher who learned cryptology from his father. Breaking codes was something easy for him, but using the telegraph companies, Yardley received all messages and decoded them. So the Americans had the upper hand in negotiations. The pinnacle of success in breaking codes is associated with Zimmermann, the German foreign minister. The incident has its roots in Iran. Wilhelm Wasmus, a German spy, was caught up in a bind in Iran, but he left some crucial documents and fled. Among those documents he left in Iran, there was a book of coding. The documents were transferred to Room 40 in the UK and then to the US. So Germany's coding system was revealed. After a while, on January 16, 1917, Zimmermann's famous telegraph message was eavesdropped and decoded. Germany was trying to spur Mexico to get into a fight with the U.S. under the pretext of recapturing its land. The U.S. was looking for an excuse, so it grabbed the opportunity and declared war against Germany. In 1929, the U.S. Army's Signal Intelligence Service was secretly activated. Following that, Yardley's cryptology office was shut down. In 1931, the book The American Black Chamber was published and details of the chamber were revealed to the media. William Frederick Friedman was at the helm of the Signal Intelligence Service. A few years later, it managed to break the Japanese coding system, which led to Yamamoto's plane crash. In a group photo, they say in Morse code image that knowledge is power. In 1941, the German U-boat submarines pose a lot of danger. The UK turned to the US for help. The Atlantic Charter was issued 4 months before the attack on Pearl Harbor. The US and Britain forged an alliance. In 1943, Washington and London signed the top secret BRUSA agreement to spy on Germany's telecommunication. Eavesdropping networks were linked up, and hence, coding, influence, and breaking codes became more serious. Finally, ultimately, the confidential UK-USA Agreement on Intelligence Signaling was secretly implemented. Australia, Canada, and New Zealand joined the accord. The hot topic those days was mechanical systems for saving searchable data called MEMEX. The idea was proposed by the science deputy of Defense Minister Bush, who had a big role in making the atom bomb.
Point of 18 years, do you have any regrets about it?
No.
As the Second World War was drawing to a close, Roosevelt died and his deputy, Harry Truman, assumed power. 4 months later, Truman issued an order for an atomic attack on Japan so the World War could end with the U.S. display of power. Truman was seeking power. The liberated lands were war booties, and in his opinion, peace was an opportunity for the next war. For the U.S., the Soviet Union was a hostile force. Yesterday's comrade became today's foe. Following the strikes in the U.S., Truman asked for more authority in Congress and set the ground for the national security to control society. Things went in a way that the dreams of the Freemason president would be guaranteed. After the National Security Act was approved, different institutions were established, including the National Security Council. After Truman and the National Security Council's approval, on November 4, 1952, an organization was established which was named the National Security Agency, or the NSA. All of the constituents of the agency were confidential. They sometimes jokingly called it no such agency. In 1957, the NSA was transferred to Fort Meade, Maryland. And in 1969, no such agency had about 90,000 employees. Hence, Truman divided the U.S. along the lines of insiders and outsiders. Amid the heat of the security activities, the U.S. was caught up by surprise by the Soviet Union. Sputnik, the first artificial satellite in the world, was launched to the Earth's orbit by the Soviet Union.
This is really quite an advancement for not only the Russians, but for international science. I think we all agree on that.
The newspaper scared people and put the politicians under pressure. Eisenhower decided to fill the gap and spoke of setting up a headquarters. 4 days later, Defense Secretary Neil McElroy told Congress about creating an agency tasked with making missiles and space missions to repel the threat. The agency was named ARPA, or Advanced Research Projects Agency. The agency kicked off its activities under the management of Johnson from General Electric. Roy Johnson left his job as a CEO with a $160,000 salary and became manager of ARPA. ARPA's $520 million budget was approved. Engineers and genius staff who had been serving the U.S. after the Second World War formed ARPA's corpus, but not all of them were American. For example, in Alabama's Huntsville missile site, German engineer Wernher von Braun was making weapons that were badly needed by the Army. By the help of such people, ARPA led major projects to success, including Defender, Vela, and Agile. U.S. Army personnel who had secretly tested the hydrogen bomb were caught by surprise once again. The evidence of an atomic blast was found in Alaska. In response to the U.S., the the Soviets tested their first bomb. The investigation revealed that they had made at least three atomic bombs. The radar systems in the U.S. were not connected, and they could have stopped working in an aerial attack. The airplanes that flew in a low altitude could easily enter the U.S. and do the job, a counterattack, or maybe a coup de grace. The solution was to connect radar systems and use the most advanced computer back then, the Whirlwind. So the Lincoln Lab was established. MIT assessed the Air Force's old plan, the Charles Project, an advanced warning network for defense in the face of a large-scale attack named SAGE. SAGE was a continental system based on 23 centers that could simultaneously trace 400 planes by using a more advanced computer named the FSQ. In 1962, Licklider, an MIT professor and author of Human-Computer Coexistence, who was looking for a really smart system, was hired by ARPA and was put in charge of the Information Processing Techniques Office, the IPTO.
The computer technology has been moving in a way that nothing else people have ever...
According to an instruction by the Department of Defense, ARPA was assigned with linking the main computers in Mount Shin, the Pentagon, and the Air Force headquarters. It was a fledgling agency which was run at a lower cost. The goal was the conceptual aspects of command and control programs for strategic aerial command. The agency was the main arm in airstrikes and was an important factor in missile attacks. The project funding was not a small amount, $5.8 million. In 1965, ARPA launched a project to create a real network. The technology was based on a theory by Paul Barron, breaking messages to smaller packages. After an extensive endeavor, finally, on October 29, 1969, efforts were made to link up the first two nodes and establish what was later named ARPANET. We typed the letter L and we asked, "Do you see the L?" They said yes. We typed O and asked, "Do you see the O?" And they said yes. Then we typed G and the system crashed. The first link between the California and Stanford universities was set up. It was a success. The network was invented. ARPANET expanded and the users could share information, but the management of the network wasn't handed over to the private sector because it was an achievement by ARPA, which was working under the Department of Defense, which had completely military priorities. In 1972, ARPA expanded its military activities and was renamed DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. In 1973, the first satellite network communication between California and Hawaii was set up, and it eventually reached London and Norway. The more ARPANET expanded, the harder it was to find out who was using it. They couldn't figure out who was linked to the network. There was no supervision. On the other hand, the political situation was chaotic due to the Vietnam War, and it had affected the U.S. The opponents of the Vietnam War, like Muhammad Ali and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., were under watch.
I have a dream.
The combination of the fast expansion of the network and lack of control over the dissidents could turn into a serious national security threat. Militarism brought the expanding ARPANET under the control of the Department of Defense. The access was more limited than before, and after a while, MILNET, namely the Department of Defense's military network, was completed and was preferred over ARPANET. Telecommunications protocols were an important issue. ARPA's preferred model was definitely TCP/IP. The Europeans suggested the OSI model. ARPA was the winner. The Foundation of Science said using ARPA's model was obligatory. Granting the finance to establish university networks was conditional on using the TCP/IP model. The pretext was ARPA's model could recognize the saboteurs of networks more quickly. The network served as a new source of revenue for the U.S., and as the Department of Defense demanded, TCP/IP was established. At the same time, hidden layers emerged, so it was easier to recognize people who logged on to the network. In 1983, establishing a network by using smaller networks based on the telecommunications protocols of DARPA was defined. After the networks linked up, the internet came to existence. Identifying the computers in the network was an important issue which was resolved with IP. Every system had a specific number. ICANN was created to protect the technical aspects and the DoD policies. ICANN, based in California, determined the name and number of computers on the internet. The identifiers included the names of domains, IP addresses, and many other parameters. The interesting point is the U.S. government is still the determiner of the names of domains on the internet and controls purchase of domains.
As most know, the internet grew out of U.S. government research, and ICANN grew out of a 1998 commitment by the U.S. government that would allow the private sector a leadership role in the management of the domain name system.
ARPA's progress in information technology would guarantee U.S. dominance. But the Department of Defense dreamed of more advanced products. Therefore, they decided to make a huge change in the telecommunication and computing industries by investing on the very large-scale integration VLSI. By executing the program, stunning technologies came into being. The outcome was 24 different products that had a huge impact in DARPA's continued progress and Silicon Valley companies like Cisco, Adobe, and Sun. The synergy between DARPA, universities, and the market was a good business model. Everyone was at the service of DARPA, and DARPA was at the service of the U.S. Defense Department. The CIA's intelligence activities were forbidden on U.S. soil, but sometimes some terrifying news was spread about the activities of a secret agency that was spying on people. Efforts were made to reveal the secret. After a year of hard work, Perry Fehlwalk, in an interview with Ramparts magazine in 1972 under the pseudonym Winslow Peck, revealed that there's a large espionage agency whose funding was bigger than the CIA. The hiding giant was emerging, but such news stories weren't noticed. The Australian Prime Minister was not aware of his country's agreement with the U.S. for a long time. After Morphy laid into the Australian Security Intelligence Organization in 1973, the clandestine deal came to light. People didn't know that the Pine Gap space station in Alice Springs, which was supposed to be involved in space missions, had turned into a monitoring station based on a secret deal and was run by the CIA. There was a plot. It took James Bamford 10 years to blow the cover from a spying system in 1982. The most important revelations were made from within the spy station. Margaret Newsham, director of computer systems who had been working for Lockheed Martin in California for 10 years since 1974, was a coordinator of the NSA's classified software in Menwith Hill Station. Her task was to install and run some software named Echelon on Lockheed Martin computers. It was clear what the agency was doing, monitoring and spying. She blew the whistle because of corruption, defrauding, and personal abuses at the agency. According to Newsom, phone calls by Senator Strom Thurmond were consistently eavesdropped on by the NSA. The NSA, the so-called no such agency, was spying, and it has penetrated people's lives to such an extent it was aware of what they were doing. After a while, in 1996, Nikki Haggar, a journalist, in his book named The Secret Power, revealed New Zealand's role in the espionage network. Based on documents, the Australian and New Zealand governments had been involved in espionage for a while and were completely aware of the developments in East Asia. A year after the book was published, Haggar and John Campbell, in a courageous move, entered the Yop station while they were filming the incidents in the operations center.
And actually, there's no people there. The whole system can run itself.
In 1988, in an article titled Somebody's Listening, authored by Duncan Campbell, the nature of the spying activities came to light. He had been under watch by the British spy agency from 1976 for the revelations he made about the GCHQ. He had achieved more details. He revealed the roles played by the US, Britain, Australia, Germany, Japan, and their program within Project 415. The satellites were not launched into space to track missiles or for telecommunication purposes. They were used solely for spying. Echelon was done. Echelon had its roots in the Second World War to track Soviet waves based on an agreement named UK-USA. The two major projects back then were Transit to track Soviet satellite communication and Echelon to track global satellite telecommunications. From 1962, there was an expanded supervision, and Echelon was used against ordinary civilians as well. It was dangerous. The technical know-how to track communications was achieved by DARPA and the NSA. Ordinary emails, faxes, telexes, and telephone calls all over the world were being tracked, listened in, and logged. The important point was Echelon had targeted all governments, organizations, and even ordinary people. To bypass the law that prohibits surveillance on citizens, the US and Britain used a simple trick to spy on their own people. They were spying on each other's sins and shared the results in the same computer. Echelon would single out the important keywords from among a large number of contacts and conversations. The keywords would include names, neighborhoods, subjects, and stuff like that that were significant for spy agencies. The important point was each country had its own list. For example, New Zealand didn't know which list the U.S. would use to assess information that it received or who the subject of the surveillance would be. After Echelon, privacy was gone forever. After more revelations, more names surfaced. Shamrock, Project Minaret, Counterintelligence Operations, and Operation Chaos. The last one was the CIA and FBI special smear campaign against dissidents. It was different from the program that was launched against students. Echelon was picky. It used a specific program to spy on different groups in Washington, D.C. The revelations reached the embassies. Mike Frost was in charge of installing surveillance tools inside the embassies. He made some revelations. Thank you.
bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
According to an opinion poll released recently, concerns over gun violence epidemic and the prospect of losing their homes have increasingly weighed on young Americans. U.S. Democrats and gun safety activists have argued that passing stricter laws would reduce gun violence in the United States, whereas Republicans and gun rights advocates are saying that arming people would act as a deterrent. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CNN Cable News Network has covered this story and tells us more. A new study has revealed that about half of young Americans feel unsafe amid concerns over gun violence and homelessness, with a quarter of them having thoughts that they would be better off dead. An opinion poll conducted by the Institute of Politics at Harvard Kennedy School showed that 48% of Americans aged between 18 and 29 have felt unsafe in the past month, with 40% worried about falling victim to gun violence and 32% concerned that they could become homeless one day. In the spring of 2023 edition of the Harvard Youth Poll, which was conducted between 13th and 22nd of March, 2,069 people between the ages of 18 and 29 were surveyed. The 45th edition of the poll also indicated that over 3 in 5, or 63%, of young Americans support stricter gun laws. According to a non-profit research group, more than 12,800 people in the United States have died from gun violence so far this year, which means an average of over 114 deaths per day. The latest report by Gun Violence Archive says there have been 168 mass shooting incidents so far this year, and that the number of mass shootings has gone up significantly in recent years. According to the poll, U.S. President Joe Biden's approval rating dropped from 39% last fall to 36% due to the worsening figures associated with violence across America. The survey also found that 47% of Americans under the age of 30 report feeling down, depressed, or hopeless, and 24% have had thoughts that they would be better off dead or have considered self-harm at least several days in the last 2 weeks. Seti Warren, director of the Institute of Politics, IOP, said the data collected in this opinion poll clearly demonstrates not only the growing level of political engagement among young people, but the urgency of addressing serious issues such as mental health, gun violence, housing, and more. Ethan Jasny, a 25-year-old student chair of the Harvard Public Opinion Project, said, "From fears of mass shootings to concerns of one day becoming homeless, the current state of Generation Z could perhaps best be summarized in one word, anxious." Generation Z refers to a generation that was born between 1997 and 2012. Ethan Jasny said, Young Americans have translated this fear into action, turning out to vote like their rights and lives depend on it. But we cannot take this engagement for granted. Public figures across the political divide must recognize the profound personal challenges that members of my generation face every day. The Associated Press has also covered the same story and tells us more. The U.S. is setting a record pace for mass killings in 2023, replaying the horror on a loop roughly once a week so far this year. The carnage has taken 88 lives in 17 mass killings over 111 days. Each time, the killers wielded firearms. Only 2009 was marked by as many such tragedies in the same period of time. Children at a Nashville, Tennessee grade school gunned down on an ordinary day recently. Farm workers in Northern California sprayed with bullets over a workplace grudge. Attendees at a venue outside Los Angeles, California massacred as they celebrated the Lunar New Year. Recently, 4 partygoers were slain and 32 injured in Dadeville, Alabama, when bullets rained down on a Sweet 16 celebration. And a man just released from prison fatally shot 4 people, including his parents, in Bordeaux, Maine, before opening fire on motorists traveling on a busy interstate highway. The bloodshed represents just a fraction of the fatal violence that occurs in the United States annually. According to an analysis of the Associated Press USA Today data, yet mass killings are happening with staggering frequency this year, an average of once every 6.5 days. The 2023 numbers stand out even more when they are compared to the tally for full-year totals since data was collected. The U.S. recorded 30 or fewer mass killings in more than half of the years in the database. So to be at 17, less than a third of the way through, is remarkable. From coast to coast, the violence is sparked by a range of motives. Murders, suicides, and domestic violence, gang retaliation, school shootings, and workplace vendettas all have taken the lives of 4 or more people at once since 1st of January this year. Yet the violence continues and barriers to change remain. The likelihood of Congress reinstating a ban on semi-automatic rifles appears far off, and the U.S. Supreme Court last year set new standards for reviewing the nation's gun laws, calling into question firearms restrictions across the country. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered this story. Academic studies have shown that 1/5 of American households bought guns during the coronavirus pandemic. According to an analysis by the Trace, a non-profit, non-partisan news organization that tracks gun violence in the United States, U.S. citizens purchased nearly 60 million guns between 2020 and 2022. All the new weapons have fueled a momentous surge in gun deaths, which reached record highs during the same period. Demand for firearms had been growing throughout the coronavirus outbreak. California, New York, Washington, Alabama, and Ohio were a few states, among others, that were reporting firearm sales growth. Gun control advocates were concerned that due to the coronavirus pandemic, many new gun owners were lacking the usual access to training on how to handle and store their weapons. The COVID-19 pandemic triggered a run on gun shops, as many Americans thought society might collapse. Nick Suplina, senior vice president of law and policy at Everytown for Gun Safety, a gun control non-profit organization, said there were fear and real concern about what happens to the country during a global pandemic. The activists said the pro-gun lobby, National Rifle Association, NRA, fanned that fear by tweeting out a video of a woman holding a rifle and pushing firearms as a pandemic safety measure. The woman says, "You might be stockpiling up on food right now to get through this current crisis, but if you aren't preparing to defend your property when everything goes wrong, you're really just stockpiling for somebody else." According to an NORC survey, some 18% of households bought guns between March of 2020 and March of 2022. Some states have tried to impose more gun control within their own borders. Recently, Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer signed a new law mandating criminal background checks to purchase rifles and shotguns, whereas the state previously required them only for people buying pistols. And recently, a ban on dozens of types of semi-automatic rifles cleared the Washington state legislature and is headed to the governor's desk. Other states are experiencing a new round of pressure. In conservative Tennessee, protesters descended on the state capitol to demand more gun regulation after six people were killed at a Nashville private elementary school last month.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray five times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini l-Islami dini wal-Azam ghayru dini Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to talk about the rules of taqlid, or following a religious scholar, a jurisprudential scholar, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are talking about the rules of taqlid or following a mujtahid and religious scholar with Sheikh Javed. Somebody said, I asked several mujtahids about the most learned mujtahid. They told me that following so-and-so would discharge me of my obligation.
Yes.
May I rely on their opinion if I personally don't know whether he's the most learned or not, or I doubt, or I am certain that he's not the most learned mujtahid due to the existence of others with similar evidence in their favor?
You're right. There are many scholars, many juries who look very much equally qualified and very much competent, and it is really an uphill task to verify which one is better qualified and which one is better eligible. Now, when it comes to to your question, of course, if a shari or legal evidence is established that a qualified mujtahid is the most knowledgeable, it is a binding proof. You know, you cannot go against the evidence. It's a binding proof which you should rely, or which is actually, reliable, because there's no evidence to contradict or to actually reject it, to contradict it. And as long as there isn't any contradiction, for example, if there are two just witnesses, and those two just witnesses, bear witness and testify that a certain mujtahid is qualified actually and very the most knowledgeable, as long as there are not two other jurists who contradict the first two jurists, then it's a shari evidence which must be acted upon, and it's a binding proof.
Mm-hmm.
So it is, of course, not necessary in such cases to look for any opposing evidence or for anything for contradiction, to see if anyone else has any other evidence to contradict the first evidence is available or not. It's not actually necessary in the first place to look for such a thing. Mm-hmm. When you come across the legal or shari'i evidence that a certain mujtahid is actually the most qualified mujtahid, then you can go ahead and follow that mujtahid.
Sheikh Shawid, is there any limit to the number of the mujtahids we can ask about, about the most learned mujtahid? How many mujtahids should we ask to find out, to seek the most learned mujtahid?
Well, there's the minimum. The minimum is a requirement is to just ask to qualify to just witnesses.
Two just
witnesses. This is the minimum.
Not even mujtahid.
Two just jurists. They cannot be two just people.
Layman.
Yeah, layman, lay individual.
Yeah.
You cannot because they have no say in such things.
Right.
And they are not anywhere to judge or to make any judgment about the competence and qualification of a mujtahid. So you can and you should ask two just persons who are jurists, who are qualified in the same field, who have done their studies in the Islamic seminary, and of course their statement, their testimony is reliable and a binding proof.
Yes.
When it comes to the maximum, of course, there's no limit. The Sharia has not specified how many individuals you can ask. Okay, the more you ask, the more the
certain
better
you become.
The more certain you become.
Yes.
And of course, the Sharia is not going to oblige you beyond your capacity, because if you go on asking and asking, probably you will end up getting confused.
Right.
So the Sharia wants to make things easy for you.
Mm-hmm.
So by asking two just persons, that's enough. You can act, you can consider it as a legal evidence and go ahead following the mujtahid you want to follow.
Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, Ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about the rules of taqlid in this program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Well, Sheikh Javid, someone doesn't have formal permission from a scholar, a religious scholar, a mujtahid, to transmit his fatwas. He occasionally makes mistakes sometimes,
yes,
in relating the fatwas. Is it permissible for him to relate, to reproduce the mujtahid's opinions? What's our duty if he does so? He relates a fatwa by reciting a book on Islamic laws.
Well, I do agree with you when it comes to some people narrating the fatwa or the verdicts of the religious authorities. Some do not have a solid information, and they just mount the pulpits and start narrating fatwas of the religious authorities without being certain or confident that the fatwa they are narrating is exactly the opinion of the jurist, so they claim to be. when it comes to narrating fatwa, actually permission is not required. Just like I, for example, I myself, I'm not a mujtahid, I'm not a scholar, I'm just a student of an ordinary student of the Islamic seminary. I just come here and narrate transmit the fatwas of His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, because I study and I have studied his books time and again. So I have never thought of obtaining permission. And, permission, so basically according to his opinion, permission is not required, as long as I'm sure this is the opinion of the religious authority, mm-hmm. whether he's His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei or another religious scholar we have in the seminary, so we can narrate his opinion. If someone makes a mistake,
right,
so the audience knows, or maybe a certain person listening to him knows that this is not the position of the mujtahid, he should correct him.
Mm-hmm.
He should correct him. And of course, so that the fatwa of that mujtahid does not lead to some kind of, let's say, misguidance or some kind of negative consequences, you know.
Right.
And so it is the duty of the listener or the audience to correct the person, the lecturer who gives, who narrates the fatwa of the mujtahid.
I see. Okay. We obtained the permission of a mujtahid who is not the most learned or knowledgeable to continue following a deceased marja. If the permission of the most learned mujtahid is required here, is it obligatory to change our following, our taqlid, to the most learned mujtahid this time and seek his permission to continue following the deceased marja?
Well, if the fatwa of the mujtahid who is not the most learned in this matter is similar to that of the most learned mujtahid, there is no problem in following the former. And it's not required to change to the most learned mujtahid either, because they hold the same position. They have the same fatwa, and the result is actually the same. So it doesn't make any difference whether you stay in taqlid of the former mujtahid who's no longer alive, or who is actually alive, but he is less qualified, and the fatwa of a mujtahid who is the most knowledgeable and the most eligible person but is qualified. So the position, the fatwa, is the same, and it doesn't make any difference to act according to the former or the latter mujtahid, because they have the same position.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, and thank you very much, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me and the whole crew here. We say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.